So it kind of defies belief in a way, though, doesn't it? This communicating psychically, and this woman that, although well-read, wasn't obviously capable of writing all this herself from her own.
No, she didn't know these teachings.
For
example, as she said, she wrote a book called Esoteric Astrology. She wrote the book for the Tibetan, and as she herself said, I don't know anything about astrology. So it was obviously material that she could not have summoned up out of her own consciousness or out of her own past studies. And the way that they worked together began in the early years with a word-to-word communication, mind-to-mind, as much as an executive dictates a letter to a stenographer. Later on, their minds merged so fluidly together that she was able to receive whole, complete ideas and write them down. And she would do her writing early in the morning, virtually every morning of her life, even when she was traveling or ill. She would begin work at about 4 o'clock in the morning, unless the Tibetan himself were too busy to dictate to her, because he had his duties in his lamasery. But what he wanted was to be able to give out the ageless wisdom teaching in a style and in a language, the English language, that would be suited to the Western spiritual seeker. So it is a teaching that is free of a lot of the Sanskrit terminology. A lot of the Eastern concepts have been restated or reconfigured for the Western spiritual seeker. I think none of us can really explain or understand how their minds work together. But if you've ever known somebody that you were very close to, where there was a very strong inner contact, mind to mind, where you knew each other's thoughts and impressions and could complete each other's sentences, you can get some idea of how these two minds could work together, just some idea. But in any case, as each of the books says in its preface, you don't have to believe any of that in order to study the books. And every book begins by saying, believe only that which strikes your intuition as true. Don't accept it as the words of some great spiritual teacher if it goes against your sense of truth. So ultimately, the nature of their work together and the facts about it are really neither here nor there. What matters is, what use do you make of the teaching? Does it seem to you true? Does it give you a view of the world and of humanity's place in the divine plan that seems right and that awakens a sense of your own commitment and your own responsibility? That's all that matters.
I wonder, too, then, the effect of all of this on Alice Bailey in terms of her own, if you like, spiritual development. That obviously some of it's got to rub off. Have you got any sort of an insight into...
Well, there is not a great deal said about her, but I do agree with what you're saying, that she was quickened and stimulated by this contact. I'm sure she was. She sacrificed a great deal in her life to bring these teachings out. As I say, she got up at 4 o'clock every morning. The spiritual discipline on a personal level and the strain on her bodies, mental, emotional, and even physical, must have been enormous to be disciplined and receptive and pure enough to take down this teaching. I can't imagine what that must have exacted, and her health gradually failed. The last 10 years of her life, I don't know how she kept going, but she did, until she finished this writing project, plus the fact that she had her own school, the Arcane School, which...
Yes, my next question, yes. So what led her, was that out of all of this experience? Why did she set up this Arcane School?
Well, that was a completely separate, if you could say, soul-chosen project. And that goes back to an interesting incident when she was a young woman. She tells about it in her autobiography. When she was about 15, she was home alone one Sunday morning, The family was off at church, and she must have been sick because she was at home alone, when a man walked into her parlor where she was sitting. He was dressed as an Indian. She never had seen him before, and he looked at her and said that there was some work she could do if she could stop being such a pain. She was, after all, 15. Well, she was astonished by this, and he quickly left, and she forgot about it. But later on, when she began to formulate the idea of establishing a school of spiritual development, she remembered that visit. And the way she described it, it was a soul-chosen task that her soul had accepted even before she was born. And she wanted to provide a system of spiritual training based on meditation, on spiritual study, and on the application of what one was receiving in meditation and study in a way that would be of service to humanity. So the objective of this school, which she named the Arcane School, was not for self-development, but to prepare one to be of service to the plan, which is the blueprint for the divine purpose for our world. And each of us, every human being, has a part to play in that plan. And the objective of the Arcane School is to help the student awaken to his soul's part in God's plan, where he is most needed. It might be some great task if one is suited for it, such as working in the political field or the cultural field or whatever. It might just as well be being a better citizen of one's community, being a teacher, being a homemaker, being someone who works in an office and somehow helps to uplift the quality of the office, running a business along a more ethical line. So it depends on the person's circumstances, but every one of us can be of service.
In our own way.
In our own way. And awakening to what one's soul's responsibility is a major step on the spiritual path.
And I think one that for some people who haven't found that, and my sense is too that that can grow and evolve and change too,
yes,
as life goes on.
Sure.
That it's, you know, the question is, well, how do you find that?
Yes, how do you find
it? In a sense of frustration.
Mm-hmm. My answer to that always is, do the next thing that you can think of to do. You may not see the ultimate goal. Most of us don't.
And it may not be big and romantic. It could be raising healthy, happy children. Like, mm-hmm, it doesn't necessarily mean big, momentous things.
No, no. Be humble would be the first guideline. Be humble and be decentralized enough within oneself to be responsive to the need in front of you. It might be the need of a neighbor or a child or a coworker or whatever, but it's a matter of turning your consciousness outward into the world. So many people think the spiritual life is introspective and inward turned, and for many people it is. We're trying to figure out who we are and what's going on inside of us, and we're looking inward. It's as if all the arrows are pointing inward. But in fact, spiritual consciousness leads outward to a place within the whole. And when one finds one's rightful place in that whole, one is content to be wherever one is placed, to bloom where you're planted. So many people say, oh, I could be of service if only I could get a college degree or dump my husband or raise my kids or move to the next city. But it has to start where you are right now. And in being faithful in one's commitment to meeting the need in one's environment, new opportunities come. But we begin where we are.
And that's about acceptance of what, mm-hmm, is here and, mm-hmm, a certain trust.
Yes, exactly. Acceptance and trust. And I think it's hard to explain, but why should one not be content to be where one is if wherever that is, one is still a part of the whole? You know, it's the, what is it, God is a being whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. So God's center is everywhere. You don't have to go anywhere to be your divine self. You're in the right place now. But you have to awaken to it and be unselfish enough to have a space in your consciousness for the world around you.